Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Good morning, everybody. It's Wednesday, April 6th, 10 o'clock on the Eastern Seaboard, and we're going to be speaking today to socioeconomic research scholar Orrin M. Levin-Waldman. His firm is called Econ Labor, E-C-O-N, and then Labor, L-A-B-O-R. And his most recent essay, which we published only yesterday, is called "The Elites Are Clueless When It Comes to Working People." So good morning, sir. How are you?
Good morning.
Well, I was just blown away by the brevity, but then that you encompassed in this latest essay, because it told a panoply of issues and put it together succinctly, pertinently, and explained it so lucidly that I was like in shock. It was like every concept that you brought forward was like a home run. Every concept like hit me right between the eyes. There was no way to escape it. It was like you were taking no prisoners when you began this whole process. So what made you think of the elites are clueless when it comes to working people? You've been talking about this for years, and somehow it came to a head. What was the impetus for it?
It's just everybody's talking out both sides of their mouths when it comes to helping one another in terms of public policy. And the policies they're proposing really make absolutely no sense. So you have, administration talking about green energy. Meanwhile, we have an energy crisis at the moment. We have insufficient oil to meet our needs. Prices are rising, is causing inflation. Didn't have to be this way, but the administration that pushes green energy is the same administration which basically has been waging war on fossil fuels. So then to deflect attention from that, they basically say, well, we're not responsible for inflation. It's Putin that's responsible for inflation. Well, that's not true. You are responsible for inflation because you basically killed the Keystone XL pipeline, which was our source of energy independence. It's true that we would have been fossil fuels are on their way out anyway, but you hasten the process without a sufficient transition period where the two overlap. And without that sufficient transition period, we find ourselves in this mess we're in right now with rising prices, and we basically acted precipitously. We acted precipitously largely because we have an administration that is hell-bent on undoing everything that Trump did for the sole reason that Trump did it. Therefore, this administration has to be the exact opposite. And it's basically thoughtless public policy.
Well, that is adversarial attitude that somehow has ingrained itself into both political parties is definitely recognized. But how is it that one party or the other, it doesn't matter which side you look at it, is trying to undermine the other, and yet the people and the public or the public interest is forgotten in the process, and there is no transition? Don't staff, if let's say not the president, but doesn't staff, aren't they there to support the president and their attitude towards things? Or is everybody afraid to talk and they just have a job and then they're happy? You come back tomorrow.
I think there are presidents here who basically has his own ideas. His ideas are stuck in 1970 when he ran for the Senate for the first time. He hasn't had a new idea since then. He hasn't had an original thought. He's been wrong on every single foreign policy question. As Robert Gates stated in his book, and instead of acknowledging that he's made mistakes, he just doubles down and says, I'm right, you're wrong. And if he has a staffer who tells him he's wrong, that staffer's on his way out. So basically, we talk about White House staff, we talk about congressional staff. Staffers know that their job is to basically be yes people for the people they're serving.
Well, are we starting to see a change? Because you've been talking about this for years, and evidently it's captivated enough minds and enough people. We were always talking about people at the lower socioeconomic ladder. So you're looking at people who work for Amazon, this progressive firm, or progressive, probably one of the most, one of the richest men in the world, certainly in the top five. And he doesn't have a union shop in Amazon. And all of a sudden they voted, I think it was only in Staten Island, they voted for unionization there. And even Starbucks, there was one place that won the right to have a union shop. But these companies have fought the people who want a union. And what does that say about the people who are the workers? Are they taking control or beginning to?
I think what you see is our workers who are, in some cases, not even so much striking over the pay issue as much as they are striking over the working conditions, which are abysmal, you know. And they're particularly abysmal in Amazon, where you're timed, you know, you have to get things from the warehouse, put them in packages, and so on. So you have to do it in a specified period of time. If you basically takes you longer to do it, you get docked, or sanctioned or something. You don't even have time to go to the bathroom because, you know, that's taking too long to get the whatever my merchandise and packages. So this is conditions are really abysmal. It's basically a sweatshop. I've read books about this by people who are going on the ground to investigate what working conditions are. And Amazon basically, in many cases, particularly in facilities in the South, that it's hot, humid, they're on air conditioned, and then you're not paying the greatest wages to begin with. So here you have this progressive CEO who owns the Washington Post, which is basically writing all these editorials about how progressive and woke we need to be. At the same time, he's mistreating his own workers. So I see the hypocrisy here. And I think what you've seen, particularly in the aftermath, not even in the aftermath because we're still living in it, but of the pandemic, is that basically a lot of workers, particularly in jobs where they have to have contact with people, have decided, and they're low-paying jobs, it's hospitality industry, the restaurant industry, they're basically saying, these are lousy working conditions. I don't feel like working here anymore. You're not paying me enough to work here under these conditions, so I get sick. And yet the right comes back and says, that's because we've given you government assistance, and therefore we've paid you benefits to scoff at work. Well, that's not true. The issue is, if you offered people decent working conditions, maybe they'd want to work. But you're not offering decent working conditions. And yet these are the elites that are making public policy. And they can't understand why the public is turning against this administration, the Congress, the Democrats in Congress. They can't understand any of this. It's a communications issue. We haven't communicated our concern, our issues properly enough to them. In other words, it's really this was the argument that when in the face of the Tea Party movement, President Obama then basically said, I have to communicate better why it's important to pass the Affordable Care Act. Never mind, the Affordable Care Act may not have been the best policy approach that you could have taken, but we have to communicate better. It's almost like we have to have re-education camps for the masses because they just don't understand how stupid they are and how smart we are.
Are we just calling people dumb and ignorant, or are we starting to wake up those people that have to work, you know, in the supermarket, and they not only do they not get paid very much, but they also have to go under the threat of working whether they're sick or they're not. or even getting some sort of contagion. And then they have kids as well. What do you do with the kids when the schools are not open and they're not, and they don't have computers and they don't have all these facilities that everybody else seemingly has? How do they tie that all together, or do they just scoff at it and say, "Oh, the hell with it"?
Well, I mean, this has been the basic problem. On the one hand, you say, "Why don't you go back to work?" And they say, "But wait,
yeah.
The schools are closed. We have no place to put our children." On the other hand, they
yeah.
say, "Well, you know, you need to get tested. Everybody needs to be tested on a regular basis." Well, why? If you have a system of voluntary testing, you know, home
mm-hmm.
testing, if somebody tests positive, they are not going to say they tested positive if it means that they're going to lose pay from work. I think
right.
this is the issue. If you test positive and then you say, listen, you're going to quarantine for 5 days, 10 days, whatever it is, but you'll lose pay.
Mm-hmm.
These are low-wage workers. They can't afford that kind of loss.
No. So why is it that so much of society believes that we're helping out people at the lower end of the job market when they don't have the facility to function on for the amount of money that they earn? And so does that work for our society overall, or does that not strain everybody at every level of the socioeconomic ladder?
You know, ultimately it's going to come back to bite people, everybody.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think the elites think in these terms. But the elites basically say, oh, rising prices, we have inflation. Ah, we know what to do about it. Have the Fed raise
mm-hmm.
interest rates. Most people will be okay. But there are going to be a few people who will lose their jobs. But we're not among those who will lose their jobs because we don't work in factories anyway. So it doesn't affect
uh-huh.
us. Not a problem.
Yeah.
You know, the Fed Reserve, the board of governors, those to hike interest rates because that's the standard practice. Okay, not
yeah.
a problem. They're not losing their jobs. It's some unidentified person who's working in some factory someplace that can't expand now because of the cost of expansion has increased, or because demand for goods and services, particularly durable goods, which are sensitive to interest rates. You have to finance something. You're not going to finance it. You're not going to buy it. Then these are the people who are going to be losing their jobs. It doesn't affect us. So the elites basically are unable to see the plight of others because it really has no bearing on them. This, I think, has been
mm-hmm.
a problem during the pandemic all along. The elites basically are able to work remotely from home during the pandemic. They don't have to go into the office. So, again, if you talk about a lockdown or remote work, it doesn't affect them.
Yeah.
They're doing just fine. There's no loss of income.
So where do we go from here? Are we just going to have a divided nation of people who make enough money, can work wherever they want? They don't have to go into an office, and they feel protected, and and the communities that they live in, the schools are open. And so they're living the good life. And so many other people that we probably depend on them, don't we? We depend on them delivering the fruits and the vegetables and the chickens and whatever else that is at the lower end. But these people don't earn a buck. You know, I even heard that there are people who, you know, they clean the chickens and on an assembly line. Sometimes they don't even allow the workers to leave to go to the bathroom, and they just have to stand there for the full shift, literally urinating in place because they're not permitted to go. I mean, or they'll lose their job. I never heard of such draconian concepts. And this is supposed to be okay?
Well,
do we not know what's going on?
If you think about the concept of wage labor, the employer essentially owns you for the shift that you are at work. So, yeah,
uh-huh.
You're basically temporarily his or her property, they can basically set the working conditions. And I think this is what, again, this is not what's understood with these, you know, Amazon organization and the Starbucks organization. These workers are actually striking over working conditions more so than than other issues. In Starbucks, I think the issue was, you know, was workers felt that those with seniority were losing out to new to new workers, and they felt that we have seniority, we should have more benefits, we should have a little bit more pay than people who are just hired. And I think, you know, just, again, if you want to have people's loyalty to a corporation, you should reward people for their loyalty to the company with higher pay. But this is not something that that the elites kind of necessarily grasp. They're in it to make their own money, and they couldn't care less. The same elites who talking about how we should be concerned about the plight of this group and that group in the United States have massive investments in China, and they're willing to overlook China's human rights.
Yes. Yes, that's right. How long can this continue, are the elites who govern that we've elected into office, not everyone's elected them into office, but certainly enough people have elected them into office, they run the roost, and it's whatever they say goes, and yet the people at the lower socioeconomic ladder don't even have the time to even be aware that some of these people are running for office. And then you hear this BS from people like Ocasio-Cortez, who's supposed to be everybody's savior, and she didn't show up, as you pointed out in your essay, to Amazon and say, hey, I support you guys unionizing. She didn't even come in to celebrate it. So how is it that we buy this BS, or we don't know?
Well, I think she was supposed to speak at one of his events, and then she pulled out when she thought there wasn't going to be enough support for it. And then when it turned out there was more support, she wanted to come back and speak. That's when the leadership said, the hell with you. We don't need you now. You weren't there for us initially. Now you just want to come in and soak up the glory. We don't need you for that. But again, it shows you the hypocrisy of people like her. She's basically a mouthpiece for whatever movement you have. And basically, AOC is about AOC. She's narcissistic. Mm-hmm. It's basically all about her. But she couldn't care less about anybody else. She's been telling this tale that she comes from the Bronx. She doesn't come from the Bronx. She grew up in Westchester County, in Yorktown Heights. So she's not exactly a poor immigrant, so to speak. She basically is an American who was born into a middle class family in Westchester County, who despite her brief sojourn as a bartender, did find a way to make it to Boston University.
Yeah. Amazing. Is it conceivable, or is there any society out there that where the people who are not earning the biggest bucks in the world and are doing some sort of menial work of some sort, they're not earning the money, are they respected more? Is there a society that's doing that, or is there no such thing? And there's always a hierarchy. There's one in a higher place, in a better place, and there's a lack of concern and interest in others that are not being as successful as you. And why don't we train our people to be more? Or do we always need people at the lower end of the socioeconomic ladder? Does everyone need to be picking grapes and fruit at upstate New York?
Well, one theory is that each group and whatever rung of the ladder they happen to be on needs a group to be below, beneath them, so they can feel better about themselves. That's one theory that may be out there. Another theory is that, you know, we've always had a stratification in society, in the economy. But what has made the U.S. unique is this belief that anybody can move up the ladder. So anybody can – there is something called upward socioeconomic mobility.
Yeah.
And it's open to all. If you work hard enough, then you too can move from impoverished circumstances to at least the middle class and maybe beyond, higher up to be among the wealthy. That's not something that existed in the old feudalistic European countries prior to the American Revolution. Basically, you were born into a class which was caste-like, and you died in that class. The only way out of that class was either through revolution or death. That's why revolutions were such historic events, because it could change the lot of people at the bottom of the ladder. We didn't have that problem here. So Americans make this big mistake, especially the right-wing pundits, you know, like in Sean Hannity, you talk about, you know, American exceptionalism. To him is, we're a better nation than the rest of you. We're great.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not really what American exceptionalism is. American exceptionalism is this idea that we were not born with the feudalistic baggage of the old country, of Europe. In other words, that paved the way for this belief in upper socioeconomic mobility. Now, that means that you have to have an economy which offers that opportunity for upper socioeconomic mobility. And it's not clear that the economy offers those opportunities any longer.
Yeah, that's it, because we have a larger population than we have jobs. Is that the thing? And there's also the bias of the past that is still haunting us. Because not everyone has an opportunity to climb out of the gutter, so to speak, or socioeconomic gutter, to move up and become a doctor or a scientist. We don't afford that education, do we?
I don't know we provide the education needed for that to happen, but we're certainly not providing it across the board equitably, equally in terms of K to 12. People who are born into, you know, I'd say more fortunate circumstances, let's say more middle class circumstances where they have two parents and they're getting a decent public school education and maybe it's being reinforced at home, they're more likely to do better in college and they may be more able to go on to become doctors or whatever else, whereas people born into impoverished circumstances, when they have single mother households and basically, the poor school systems, the education is not reinforced in the household, they are not going to do nearly as well. So the opportunities are closed. And then if you have a changing economy where we are putting greater emphasis on skills, on certain abilities, and you need training for those new jobs, unless you have those skills, unless you have that kind of training, then there really is no opportunity to make it. And that's really what was happening. It used to be a time, in an agrarian economy in 1787, if you could acquire some land, farm it, maybe expand it, and then keep expanding, you had a potential to become wealthy. In a industrialized or post-industrialized economy where, you know, most of the resources are owned by fewer people who have shares in various corporations. And the only way that you can make it now is if you get a good, solid tech education. So you can work in the high-tech industry. Then the opportunities are very limited for you. So then the American dream becomes closed. And then this idea of exceptionalism becomes nothing more than a myth. It's no longer true. It was for a while. It's not true anymore.
Wow. Is there a way to get out of this rut, or is this going to be the template for the next 25 or 50 years?
Well, the first thing that you could do, and again, liberals and people in the woke industry don't necessarily want to hear this, but we could start putting a greater emphasis on families, two-parent families, why that's important for raising of good children, and for children who are more likely to do better in life than those who come from single-family households, single-parent households.
Yeah.
That's the first thing. The second thing we could do is we could put more of investment into K-12 education. And that may involve, in some cases, you know, having more options for, vouchers for private schools, charter schools, whatnot, giving parents choice in the schools that they can send their kids to. Even in impoverished neighborhoods, that's something that liberals don't want to hear about it because the teachers' unions don't want to talk about it. So that's something we need to seriously consider. We, instead of investing money into green energy and things like that, we really should be investing money into improving our school systems.
And is the aversion because our teachers' unions they keep earning more and more? They have a very powerful union and they're very important. Earning too much, or is it just like as a society we're not investing where we need to invest?
I don't think it's a question of them earning too much or. I think it's a question of they see any kind of option, alternative to a traditional public school education as an assault on public schools. And the fear is that they'll lose their jobs. If the parents basically say, we're going to send our kids to private schools, then there's no need for public school teachers. If you say, let's have charter schools as an alternative, even within the public school system, those who are not good enough to teach in the charter schools feel that they'll be left behind, and they're concerned that they'll lose their jobs. So it's basically, they want to have rules in the game to ensure their jobs, but for people who claim to want to be in this for educating children, that doesn't appear to be their goal.
Yeah. I guess that's self-preservation, isn't it? Is that part of the human nature? You know, somebody gets a gig or they might even know somebody, they pass a test that could be mediocre, but once they're in the system, they're in the system, unless they really mess up badly.
It's part of the survival system. It's contrary to a market economy built on competition.
And does the public, that isn't earning such high return on their output, on the work that they do, are they aware of all of this, or do they just feel impotent and incapable of changing the equation? Or is there like a groundswell of, new teachers or new type of industry that people can get into that will give them a much better livelihood? Well, we haven't gotten there yet.
I'm not sure we've gotten there yet, but I think, again, you have a lot of parents who understand this, but there are also many who feel that they are helpless to make any serious changes. And, again, if you are low income yourself and you're living in a poor community and you don't have the resources, so therefore the school system is not terribly good, the school board is not likely to listen to you anyway.
Maybe you should get a glass of water or something. Are you okay?
Yeah, I'm fine.
So there is no impetus, is there, for a change? Is that because people are comfortable where they are, and those that are not comfortable don't seem to have the political prowess to make a change? It certainly took a long time for unionization over at Amazon and with Starbucks and constant assault. And why doesn't our government somehow engender that our people do become unionized? Is there a problem for them that way, or are they serving the elites who own the Amazons of the world or the Starbucks of the world? So are those the people we're serving? The big honchos at the top of the food chain?
Amazon is serving its customers, and Amazon's customers want low prices. So unionization has the potential to drive up the prices of Amazon goods. That's contrary to, I guess, how Bezos would see the public interest. If Bezos is called upon to define the public interest as, you know, cheap consumer goods. So that's your first problem. These people also never really understood the needs of workers. Workers are basically selfish in their minds, and the reason you join a union is to artificially inflate wages to get wages beyond your worth. That's the way many among the elite think, especially if they're part of the managerial class.
But these people, well, I don't know how Bezos grew up or if he just lucked out, had a great idea and was able to traverse the entire range of it all and became a billionaire, one of the richest men in the world. Or did he have a very, very good background? And what makes him forget what it was in the very beginning? Or is it now it's all about him now?
I don't know much about his background. Some of these tech titans actually start off as in financial markets as investors, and then they sort of found the right investment, and they ran with it. Some start off as, you know, computer people writing programs, and they had an idea that they could monetize what they were doing in terms of sales. I don't really know much about his background, other than once he became wealthy through Amazon, he then decided to diversify and purchase other enterprises, including the Washington Post. Now, some of these people may feel that because they've become so wealthy, they feel maybe some twinge of guilt over that, so they have to make up for it by supporting various public service causes, whatever you want to call them, maybe even some woke causes to show their credentials and say, I'm progressive too. If I'm progressive, then I can't be one of those nasty, horrible billionaires that, you know, Bernie Sanders talks about.
And yet we don't hear very much from our political class, do we? The people in office, they just seem to want to be in office. I don't always know what they do because I don't think they do very much. So some people do provide for the community that they serve, and others really don't. It's basically, you know, it's like a game. It's like we hear the same litany no matter what, and I think it goes over a lot of people's heads. They don't recognize that it's just a script.
It's a script. It's a script on the one hand. It's a full-time job on the other hand for politicians.
Yes.
And that's not the way it was supposed to be. It was actually supposed to be, you know, you were supposed to be a part-time citizen legislator. Congress would be in session for a couple months of the year. And then you go home to your district. You live among the district. You probably go back to whatever your occupation was in your district because you weren't getting a full-time salary. You only get paid for 2 months to do in Washington. So you go back to your previous occupation, and you'd be among your fellow constituents. That's no longer the case. Now it's you paid $175,000 to be a member of Congress, and it's a full-time job. You get a staff and resources to run an office, and you know, you basically your first priority is to win the next election. And no sooner are you reelected, then you focus on the next election. So your goal is to win elections. Your goal is not necessarily to serve your constituents. Actually, serving your constituents becomes secondary to the primary goal of winning the election and winning re-election.
Yeah.
So we turn this into a full-time occupation for some of these people, to the point where some people have been in Congress for 35, 40, 50 years. And
yes,
if they were to leave Congress, have no idea what to do with themselves. They have no other skills other than to be mouthpieces in Congress. But that what we've seen in recent years, these mouthpieces are no longer mouthpieces for their district. They're mouthpieces for the political party of which they have to be a member of. And what they can't seem to grasp is that when their constituents actually defy them and basically say, we don't like what you're doing here, that's a problem for them. They don't understand. They thought, well, with advances in technology, they would be able to run a good ad campaign and manipulate public opinion in their favor. So their whole attitude was, they don't have to listen to their constituents. Why would you listen to stupid constituents? They have all the answers. They're politicians. They know. And they hire people to tell them that they know. What more can we ask for?
I have absolutely no idea, to be honest with you. I don't think even the public is aware that a lot of these people who had nothing when they began this process, and somehow they were the flavor of the month, and they got elected into office, they're now millionaires. They're able to get inside information on stock tips, and it's not illegal for them, but it is for the regular people, even the ones who are wealthy. Was it Martha Stewart? Didn't she get fined for some inside information? Whether it was inside or not, I have no idea. But she got fined. But if you were someone in Congress or in the Senate, yeah, it would be okay.
Martha Stewart actually went to jail.
Do they? Yes, she did.
She actually went to jail.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and it took a long time for her to resurrect her business too. But the public doesn't know that, and maybe the media doesn't even tell them that, or maybe they do. I don't read everything under the sun, so
I think the public does know that to a certain extent, and they just don't care. And I think what you've seen in recent years, where some politicians basically say, okay, I've been knocked down a peg by the scandal. Even after coming out of jail or something, I can actually make a political comeback. So without seeing Andrew Cuomo saying, now maybe I can run for governor again because, you know, people still have forgiven me. They've forgotten about me. You have Anthony Weiner, you know, is made in some ways maybe making his political comeback. He too figured the public would forget what he did and get away with it. And the truth is, when the public sees people, or these politicians seeing people like Donald Trump makes the kind of statements he makes about grabbing women by their private parts, and no problem, he still gets elected. They're saying, why can't we do exactly the same thing? We'll atone for our sins publicly. We'll flagellate ourselves on television. We'll say we're sorry. Wait a few months. The public forgot all about the sins, and they go on.
Yeah. Boy, my God, it seems like such a template for those people who live that lifestyle. That's amazing. My God. So ethics are gone, right? They're out the window now. We do whatever it takes to survive. Maybe that's one of the reasons we don't really, we're not concerned about COVID, whether we wear a mask, we don't wear a mask. It doesn't really matter. We do whatever we want, and everything's okay. That's it.
Well, that's the other thing. That's something also misunderstood. Ethics has nothing to do with morality, what's right or wrong. It has to do with the reigning ethos of the community, of the standards of the time.
Okay.
So ethics change. The standards of the community
change over time.
So what was unethical at one time now becomes ethical today. What was unethical because it was illegal at one time, or maybe it was legal, and then we say it's unethical now, becomes illegal when a new law is passed. So ethics change. It's not a static concept.
Well, I definitely feel like an albatross when it comes to that. Or dinosaur. You know, it just seems like time has passed me by. So I've no idea if I still fit into the equation, or it's just fun somehow to be a little different because of that. So very interesting. Where are we going then? Because at one time, you know, standards of ethics told you where to go. You knew where to sit because you knew who you were. Things are different nowadays, and people are all over the place, and it seems to be so self-aggrandizing. It's a little bit disturbing to me because I don't see what society gets out of it. There's no contribution.
Well, each person or each entrepreneur sees the contribution differently.
Yes.
But that doesn't mean it benefits the public.
Right. Very interesting. So do you see a difference in our attitude? Are we evolving into something different? Is this like, are we crossing the Rubicon, so to speak? Is there something on the other side of this river? Or is it just like a regular effect of life and times change and different circumstances move us, cajole us to go one way or the other? Or is this like the latest gig? You know, we can do whatever we want because we can get away with it.
I might believe that if I saw more public officials, politicians, office seekers talking about how we could make for a better economy, a better labor market, would create jobs which actually pay workers decent, livable wages. Instead, I hear them bloviating about the same things they've been bloviating about for years. And then when they realize that there's nothing they can do to bring back manufacturing to this economy, there's nothing they could do or they want to do to raise people's wages, they deflect, they divert attention. They start talking about the woke cause of the week, how we have to preserve the Supreme Court, so liberals on the court, so we have abortion rights forever, kind of thing. Or from the other side, Republicans, how we have to oppose Jackson's appointments to Supreme Court because, after all, she worked as a federal public defender and she represented the interests of terrorists accused of terrorism, and therefore as a judge, she gave out leading sentences to pedophiles. Therefore, she's soft on crime. And to boot, she couldn't define. She wasn't willing to define a woman. For some of these people, the questions that they were asking were just asinine, to say the least, and had nothing to do with the real question they should have been asking her: what is your judicial philosophy?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
What is the proper role for judges in a system of separation of powers?
Yeah. Amazing. I feel like somehow your essay really just showed us how dumbed down we are. We're in it's a reality. It's set in. It feels like this is a new edifice in front of us, and it doesn't look like it's going to be crumbling soon at all, if ever. Or do we just ratchet up the differences among us? And like I don't even understand, like, you know, there's certain things I can afford, for example, and other things I can't afford. So you're not going to see me in a Rolls Royce, not because I wouldn't like to have a Rolls Royce. I mean, I think it would be nice. However, I can't afford it. So maybe I can afford a Hyundai or a Kia or maybe something middle of the road. I don't know, like a Chevrolet or something, whatever. But what happens if you don't have those things don't really matter at the end of the day, but where do we go with all of this? That's, you know, what are we supposed to accomplish here? Why are we even doing all these things? Like, does everybody need to have a Rolls Royce? Is it bad to have a Kia? What are we trying to do here? I don't know. When so many people can't even make a buck. And then why is it that if we can afford all those things, even a Kia, how come we can't afford to pay somebody who's working the fields in upstate New York picking fruit or berries? The people who are picking berries in upstate New York, they're competing with blueberries that come from Chile and Peru. I was at the supermarket only a few days ago, and it said blueberries from America. And when I looked at the package, it said it was made in Peru, and there was another package made in Chile. So we're flying this stuff over, and I bet you we're not paying the people in upstate New York a living wage. So what's going on? I don't get it.
Well, sometimes the elites want to impress upon people that they're better, and how much better they are than the general masses. So, yeah, so they have to show off in their Teslas and their, Ferraris and whatever status car they have to be driving, or whatever the flavor of the week happens to be. In some ways, it's you could argue, okay, so if other people see people driving around in these cars, it becomes an aspiration. They have something to live for. They have something to work for. It brings out their inner discipline that they work hard and maybe become, successful and acquire those toys themselves. On the other hand, it maybe seems a little obscene when you're talking about giving tax credits for people who buy Teslas, but people can't afford to pay their rent.
Correct. So, and how does that come about? Is that because we like, Musk? We want him to make a profit, and we cover it up and making believe that this is ecologically the way to go. If it's so pertinent, then why do we have to give an incentive for people to buy it? That how we're selling it?
You have to give people incentive to buy it because it's not obvious to most people why they should be driving a Tesla as opposed to a regular gas-powered engine. There are certain inconveniences to driving these cars that are not readily apparent. I mean, one, you have to have the electric power cord to power the car. That may involve, in many cases, calling your electrician, having one installed on a certain dedicated line. Then that's an investment of $1,000 to $1,500 up front for just need to make in your house. You truly have to
and
have the space
knows
to do
how
it.
Much, and nobody even knows how much it's going to cost to recharge your battery for electricity. They don't tell you if it's like $20 or $30 to fill up the tank.
Actually, in some cases, it's cheaper to continue driving your gas cars because it doesn't come out any cheaper in the long run to drive your electric cars. See, but you also have the space to have private garages so you can basically make this happen. Only the wealthy really have that. When you get right down to it, unless you're willing to go to a charging station and sit there for a couple of hours, which people don't feel like doing, then it's really not obvious why you'd want to have one of these electric cars. The other issue is,
well, if you want to have a reason to read a book, say, okay, fine, I'll fill up the battery, and I'll read something in 3 hours. It's okay. While you're waiting.
You could do that. But the issue is, if you're talking about a car which starts at $55,000, then and the person's saying, but I could still get a Audi for $45,000 or a BMW for maybe a little less money. Why would I do that? Why would I buy the Tesla? And a lot of Teslas are costing $90,000. So the only way you can get them to buy these cars is by offering them a tax break, which, again, seems, you know, it's not targeted for the middle class. It's really not helping the poor. It's basically targeting the wealthy. And this is basically a waste of money. And we've seen this kind of waste of money in government stimulus programs all along. Here you're giving stimulus checks to people who never even lost their jobs during the pandemic. What was the point of that?
I have no idea. I know there were people, for example, who claimed that they had more employees, and they would, what is they call it, a PPE. So the government gave you money to keep them employed, but they were never employed. And so you didn't save any jobs. It was just paperwork. And people made a fortune on that alone. It's amazing.
And some of them are being prosecuted now for fraud. So it's, you know.
Yes.
But part of the problem
that
there
cost
was,
money,
you know,
too.
Nobody knew how long the pandemic was going to go on for. I mean, this is what they're talking about. Okay, so we're going to shut down for 2 or 3 weeks, and then we hope to reopen the economy. So you're giving people money to that they can apply for these loans that will be forgiven if they can continue to employ their workers at full pay.
Right.
You know, at the beginning, it seemed like a reasonable offer if you believed the pandemic was going to be over or we're going to be able to reopen in 2, 3, maybe 4 weeks. But when it starts dragging on for 5, 6, 8 months to a year, 2 years, that's where it becomes untenable.
Yeah. And from an economic perspective, why aren't we changing our direction? Or are we starting to change the direction? Because aren't we exhausting the coffers of the federal government? Or we're just using the money in order to appease the public for the next election?
So here's again we have our disconnect between those who push the woke party line or the progressive line. There is, so the government can continue to spend money, just print up more money. Not a problem.
Yeah,
just print it up. We have a supersized economy. You print up more money, it won't cause too much inflation. It's the way to go. They believe it. They have economic theories to justify this. They have economic theories called modern monetary theory, MMT, which basically says you can basically run huge deficits, and it's not going to hurt the economy because we have a large size economy, so we can absorb it. Two, we can print up more money because, you know, and spend for programs because we have an economy that can support it. They don't really provide any evidence of why this is the case. And when you have former Treasury sector secretaries who maybe discredited Harvard presidents, because they weren't sufficiently woke enough, saying we really need to be concerned about inflation. But because they're disgraced Harvard presidents, they're not going to be listened to.
You got to forgive me. I didn't realize it because I was so interested in what you were saying. I didn't even look at the studio screen, but we do have some callers. So forgive me, callers, but we'll try to take in their request or their inquiry. Probably or statement. So bear with me a moment as I pull one in. Bear with me a second. Good morning. Thanks for waiting. I'm sorry for my delay. I caused it. Do you have a question or a statement to make? And what's your first name?
My first name is Ashton. How are you?
How are you? Thanks for calling. What's your question or your statement?
Don Jr., CEO, he brings me on these stations, and I'm grateful for that. I was an athlete in the Special Olympics. I don't know if y'all are familiar with the program or not. I have no idea. But that program is supported and we are exploited, okay? None of us as athletes get paid, and the government needs to stop feeding the engine of Special Olympics. They need to stop backing them. They need to stop giving money to them because they've been around for 51 years. The government gives them money. I said, y'all don't give money to other organizations like that. And then, but we're exploited. I'm an athlete. Google me, Ashton Smith, Special Olympics. Look at my book, Swimming Upstream to Realize the Dream. That's my book sold at Walmart and Amazon because it talks about how their program politically, it exploits people. It exploits these disabled people. They have their games coming up in Florida. None of us get paid. I was in their program for 37 years. And the program in Texas openly supports racism. When you Google their program, Special Olympics Texas, Confederate flag, all this stuff comes up about their program. So the government shouldn't back stuff that openly supports racism and can tell somebody like me, nigger, bye. That's what the CEO of Special Olympics told me, nigger, bye. Because I live in a state where you have right-to-work rules and all that. They can treat minorities any way they want to because they can use these rules and pay us $2 an hour. Look that up because we're considered retarded in the Special Olympics. Y'all ain't finna pay me $2 an hour while you make $66 million off my image on ESPN, and I don't get nothing. Google Ashton Smith ESPN. Do I get nothing? No, while the Special Olympics uses a political system to monetize us, but we get nothing. The government, y'all are talking about political stuff, so that's why I find it appropriate for me to say this. The government has to stop dealing with the Special Olympics. Private sponsors have to stop sponsoring them because they're sponsoring slavery. They're sponsoring that every time because Special Olympics, we're told, you don't need money. You don't need to be married. You don't need to know how to own a business, remember, because you're retarded. No, I don't want to be called retarded when I'm articulate enough to get a job on a radio station. You hear my voice, right? I don't sound stupid to y'all. At Absolutely. The end of the day, I'm better than this. I'm not going to be used and exploited for 31 years to have nothing. And y'all are a political radio station or whatever the case may be. Start finding investigative reporters to start contacting the charitable trust of every state and contact the IRS and let them know that they're exploiting us on TV and not paying us. When they say that 99 to 80% of the money goes to the athletes, help these athletes rise, no, that's a lie. Y'all helping us fail. We've never been able to rise up or be ourselves. Let me win. But if I cannot win, let me be brave in the attempt. That is the saying for Special Olympics. I'm tired of trying to be brave but be broke. I'm tired of trying to live my life in this country and selling my medals on the side of the road. If you want to listen to me talk about this on my podcast, listen to Keep Swimming with Ashton on YouTube. You'll be able to listen to me and hear me talk about this and other subjects today. I am so great.
Let me just ask you to repeat that again.
Sure.
I do want to go back to another caller that I've also put on hold. So before the professor leaves. So what's the way to reach out to your show?
They can look at Keep Swimming with Ashton. They can also find me on Instagram, Twitter under Golden Ashton. They will be able to find me and listen to me, and they can also buy my book, folks, called Swimming Upstream to Realize the Dream at Walmart today. I can get a job on any radio station. Why not me? Hire me because I want to work. I'm ready to work today. Amen?
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you so much for your input. I appreciate it very much. Be well. Thank you very much.
You too, Pastor Don,
good day.
Junior, CEO.
The best, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you. Be well. Mm-hmm. Bye. So we have another caller that's been waiting. Let me bring in that caller, and then a third caller came in. Good morning, caller. Thanks for waiting. I appreciate your patience. I'm sorry for my delay bringing you in. Do you have a question or an answer or something?
I just like
– Are you just
– I just came
ahead.
On, so I don't know what the subject is. I'm with the winning team, Pastor Don, junior CEO. My name is Louis Gregory. I'm a broadcaster. So I just came on, and yeah, I don't know what the subject was.
The subject is we're talking about the elites being clueless when it comes to working people, and that was a discussion with socioeconomic research scholar Orrin M. Levin Waldman. So you can just look up if you go to the Yonkers Tribune, probably the easiest way to do it is to look up Orrin, O-R-E-N, and you'll see his latest article. It's on the top of the page. And then maybe you can call in another day and we can discuss it even further. Is that okay?
Well, I just want to say rich people stay rich because they don't use their money. They use everybody else's money. That's why they stay rich.
That's true. Very, very true. So bear with me a moment. Since you didn't hear the discussion, let me just go to the one last caller because the professor is going to need to go. He's got scheduled to meet, and he would normally be up only till 11. So bear with me a moment. I'll put you on hold again, and I'll get back to you as well. Bear with me. Okay, 1 second. All right. There we are. And then let me bring in the last caller. They called about 2 minutes or so ago. Good morning. Do you have a question or a statement you want to make? And what's your first name?
We need the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. This is Pastor Don, Junior CEO. And I do have a question. And I want to thank the winning team members for calling in because I'm the guy who sent them into your show. With the climate being what it is, and we're getting back to life, and as we go back into our everyday, normal 9-to-5 jobs and our regular routine, how do we facilitate our energies out so that on a political climate, the politicians will hear what we're saying?
Well, that's a great question. I don't know if they're listening. But what about it, Professor? Any way that they can make a bigger impact, or is it just a done deal?
I think that you basically have to find ways to let your politicians know that whatever they stand for are not the...
Sorry a second, I'm going to put them on hold. Go ahead.
I think whatever the politicians stand for at the moment is not what where the public happens to be. And basically it's time to stop listening to public opinion polls and start looking at serious data on where the economy is at the moment, where it has come from, and where it seems to be heading. And basically that's where the public probably is. It's not where the public opinion polls say they are.
That's very true. Very, very true. Well, Professor, as always, very scintillating, always interesting, always a learning experience. Thank you very much for your most recent essay. I appreciate it very much. Enjoy the day, and then I'll get back to the other person who didn't hear the show, but maybe we'll just cover that a little bit longer. Thanks again. Have a great week. All the best.
Thank you.
Thank you. So Orrin M. Levin Waldman, he's the professor. His website address is econlabor, econlabor. His most recent essay, which we discussed today, is The Elites Are Clueless When It Comes to Working People. And you could find his article, of course, on the Yonkers Tribune website. And you'll also be able to find it at econlabor, econlabor. And so that's all very, very compelling stuff, that's for sure. And as usual, always something is a learning experience when we speak to the professor. But bear with me a moment, because what I want to do is I want to be able to tell you a little bit about some of the books that he's written, and then we'll get on to some international news. Bear with me. He's written the following works. One is called Restoring the Middle Class Through Wage Policy, Arguments for a Middle Class. And this is published by Palgrave, P-A-L-G-R-A-V-E. And then there's Understanding Public Policy in the United States. This is also written by the professor, and this is issued by, or published rather, by Top Hat, T-O-P-H-A-T. And I got introduced to him for the first time when I read the book, The Minimum Wage. And this is published by ABC-Dash CLIO, C-L-I-O. So the ABC is part of the American Broadcasting Corporation, and they have a division called CLIO. So ABC-CLIO, that's a corporate firm. Then one of the most esoteric publishers in the entire nation is a company called Routledge, R-O-U-T-L-E-D-G-E. Routledge published his book called Wage Policy, Income Distribution, and Democratic Theory, again, by Orrin M. Levin-Waldman. It's now in paperback, and it's published by Routledge, R-O-U-T-L-E-D-G-E. And then, of course, you've got The Case of the Minimum Wage, again, written by the professor. And in this book, he defines competing policy models. So it's called The Case of the Minimum Wage, Competing Policy Models. And this one is published by the State University of New York Press, so SUNY Press. And then, of course, you could find him at Econ Labor. Econ Labor, the website address, that's his office, is www.econlabor.com. And you'll find information about him and the work that he's done and the publications that he's made, as well as the books that he's written, all very, very compelling stuff, to say the least. Okay, so there we are with him, and then let's move on to something else now. Bear with me a second here. I want to get to some international news, which is really overwhelming, that's for sure. And this is very, very interesting, evidently. With regard to the Ukraine, the United States has announced new sanctions hitting Putin's daughters, major Russian banks, and this is the latest update. Washington has placed full sanctions on Russia's Sberbank, S-B-E-R-B-A-N-K, and Alpha Bank, along with targeting President Putin's adult daughters, and this is the latest. The new U.S. sanctions are against Sberbank, Alpha Bank, Vladimir Putin's adult daughters. The European Union Council president believes sanctions on Russian gas will eventually be necessary. The top U.S. general says that Ukraine war could last for years. Zelensky, aware of renewed Russian offensive in the East, and the United States is expected to enact new sanctions tomorrow, or rather today, actually, forgive me. So, the U.S. has said it will sanction Vladimir Putin's two adult daughters and apply, quote, full blocking, quote, unquote, sanctions on Sberbank, the Alpha Bank, Russia's largest public and private financial institutions. All new U.S. investments in Russia are also now prohibited. The White House said it will also sanction Putin's daughter, Maria Putina, and Katerina Tikhonova, saying that the Russian president's family members are known to hide his wealth. The sanctions freeze the U.S. assets of Putin's close family members while cutting them off from the United States financial system. The U.S. also announced sanctions on Russian Prime Minister Mikhail Mishustin, the wife and children of Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, and members of Russia's Security Council, including former President and Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev. Well, Washington said that the new sanctions were in response to war crimes committed by Russian forces in Ukraine. Well, the Ukraine authorities are calling for mass evacuations in the eastern provinces. Ukraine's Prime Minister, Deputy Prime Minister Irina Vereshchuk, has called for residents of Donetsk, Luhansk, and Kharkiv provinces to evacuate their homes immediately as Russian forces are said to be repositioning for an assault. Quote, the head of the military administrations of Kharkiv, Luhansk, and Donetsk regions are asking the population to leave these regions, she said on Ukrainian television. Quote, it is necessary now because later people will be under fire and threatened with death. They will not be able to do anything against it, and we will not be able to help them, Verushchuk had said. Quote, it is necessary to evacuate while there is such a possibility. At the moment, it is still there, she added. earlier on Wednesday, regional governor of the for the part of the Luhansk region that Ukraine still controls, Serhiy Haidai, warned of more fighting in the region as Russian troops reposition. Quote, "I think that in 3 to 4 days, they will try to launch an offensive," Haidai had said. The European Union has spent 35 billion euros on Russian energy since the start of the Russian war, of the war against Ukraine. And speaking to the European Parliament, European Union Foreign Affairs Chief Josep Borrell said that the bloc had spent €35 billion, that's about $38 million, on Russian gas, oil, and coal since the Ukraine war began in late February. Borrell cited the number to reemphasize the importance of reducing the European Union's dependence on Russian energy imports. €1 billion is what we pay Putin every day for the energy he provides us since the beginning of the war. We have given him €35 billion. Compare that to the €1 billion that we have given to the Ukraine in arms and weapons, Borrell had said. He added that the European Union would need to expand renewable energy to reduce its reliance on fossil fuels and that the fight against climate change now goes hand in hand with geopolitics. Hungary's Orbán is offering to host peace talks, says that oil and gas sanctions are unacceptable. Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orbán said he spoke with Russian President Vladimir Putin and urged an immediate ceasefire in Ukraine. Quote, "His response was positive, but with conditions," Orbán told a press conference without elaborating. The Hungarian leader, who was reelected on Sunday, added he has invited Putin to Budapest, the capital of Hungary, along with French President Emmanuel Macron, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz, and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky for talks. Orbán is seen as having one of the closest relationships of any European leader with Putin. Orbán also said that Hungary would not have a problem paying for Russian gas in rubles if asked to do so by Moscow. He added that Hungary does not support expanding European Union sanctions to oil and gas imports from Russia. Russia is demanding that European Union countries pay for gas imports in rubles in a bid to prop up the currency. However, most European countries have refused, saying existing contracts are set in euros or dollars. Convoy of buses and private cars carrying more than 500 civilians who had fled Mariupol has arrived in Zaporizhia, the International Committee of the Red Cross, the ICRC, had said. Now, this convoy's arrival to Zaporizhia is a huge relief for hundreds of people who have suffered immensely and are now in a safer location, Pascal Hunt, the International Committee of the Red Cross's head of the delegation in Ukraine, had said. It's clear, though, that thousands more civilians trapped inside Mariupol need safe passage out and aid to come in, he added. The International Committee of the Red Cross said it had tried to reach Mariupol for several days, but the security situation in the city has made it impossible. Quote, "We stand ready to facilitate the safe passage of people from Mariupol and other cities," it added. Well, speaking to the Irish Parliament, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky accused some Western leaders of considering financial losses to be worse than war crimes. Quote, "When we are hearing new rhetoric about sanctions, I can't tolerate any indecisiveness about everything that Russian troops have done," he said, referring to the atrocities revealed recently in Bucha. "The only thing that we are lacking is the principled approach of some leaders, political leaders, business leaders, who still think that war and war crimes are not something as horrific as financial losses," added Zelensky. Well, the Ukrainian president also called on Ireland to convince its European Union partners to introduce, quote, "more rigid," end quote, measures against Russia. Germany's Scholz is calling on Putin to end the Ukraine war. German Chancellor Olaf Scholz called on Russian President Vladimir Putin to end the war in Ukraine and remove Russian forces from the country. Scholz had said that Russian soldiers committed a massacre on Ukrainian civilians in Bucha. He added that those responsible for the atrocities must be held accountable. In a speech to lawmakers on Wednesday, the German leader defended his government's decision to send arms to Ukraine while also ensuring Germany and other NATO members are not active participants in the war. Scholz added that Germany would continue to support Ukraine, quote, in all ways we can, end quote. Continuing, he said, it must be our goal that Russia does not win this war, Scholz had said, adding that Germany was in confidential talks with Ukraine over potential security guarantees. China's calling the carnage in Bucha deeply disturbing, quote, unquote. China has described reports of civilian deaths in Bucha as, quote, deeply disturbing, end quote, and called for an investigation. However, Foreign Ministry spokesperson Zhao Lijian added that no blame should be apportioned until all facts are known. The truth and the cause of the incident must be verified, Zhao had said. All parties should exercise restraint and avoid unfounded accusations before a conclusion of the investigation is drawn, end quote. Russia has made a series of unfounded claims that the carnage in Bucha was staged, but images from several different sources rebut Russia's assertions. China has previously called for talks while refusing to criticize Russia. Beijing opposes economic sanctions on Moscow and blames Washington and NATO for provoking the war and fueling the conflict by sending arms to Ukraine. Well, Russia wants diplomatic relations despite expulsions of diplomats. Russia wants to maintain diplomatic relations with Western countries. Despite a series of expulsions of its diplomats, Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Alexander Grushko had said, well, Greece became the latest European country to expel Russian diplomats. The Greek Foreign Ministry declared 12 diplomats, quote, persona non grata, and ordered them to leave. Grushko's comments come after France, Belgium, the Netherlands, Romania, and Italy expelled Russian diplomats earlier this week. Nevertheless, our position remains absolutely the same. We advocate for diplomatic channels to remain open, he said. Maria Zakharova, Russia's foreign ministry spokeswoman, said, quote, for every such unfriendly act, we will give an appropriate response, end quote. She warned the suspension would, quote, lead de facto to putting bilateral relations into suspended animation, end quote. Well, Ukraine says that Russia's war has killed 167 children so far. Ukrainian prosecutor general's office said 167 children had been killed and 279 wounded in the war so far. Of the total, 78 children were killed or injured in the Kyiv region, the capital, the office had said. A further 112 children have died or were wounded in Donetsk and Luhansk regions, the latest targets of Russian aggression. There were also fatalities in Kharkiv, Chernihiv, and Mykolaiv. Well, reports, however, have not been immediately been able to be verified in the report. Pope is calling for an end to the war while holding up the Ukrainian flag. Pope Francis kissed a battered Ukrainian flag that was brought to him from Bucha. This flag comes from the war, from that martyred city, Bucha. Let us not forget them. Let us not forget the people of Ukraine, he said during his weekly audience. Cruelty that is increasingly horrendous, even against civilians, defenseless women and children. They are victims whose innocent blood cries out up to heaven and implores, stop this war, he said. The pontiff has criticized Russia's invasion of Ukraine several times and said last week he was considering a trip to Ukraine. It is unbelievable. Let me compose myself. Anyway, so the European Union will have to ban oil and gas imports from Russia to put pressure on Moscow to stop this war in Ukraine, the European Council President Charles Michel has said on Wednesday. I think that measures on oil and even gas will also be needed sooner or later, Michel told the European Parliament. So far, European Union leaders are considering a ban on Russian coal, but not oil or gas, as part of a new package of sanctions in response to possible war crimes in Bucha. Quote, now we have to look into oil and revenues Russia gets from fossil fuels, European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen told the European lawmakers. German Foreign Minister Annalena Baerbock had said on Tuesday that the European Union was working on a plan to end purchases of Russian fossil fuels together. Austria and Hungary, however, were opposed to Russian oil and gas sanctions. According to the International Energy Agency, Russian natural gas accounted for almost 40% of European Union gas demand in 2021. The European Union is the second largest importer of Russian oil after China. Ukraine's Minister for Foreign Affairs, Dmytro Kuleba, has called on the European Union to go further, saying, quote, difficult times require difficult decisions, end quote. The Netherlands has prevented 14 Russian-owned yachts from leaving Dutch harbors. The Ministry of Foreign Affairs said the 12 vessels under construction were held at the shipyards. Another two that were in for maintenance are also being held. Yacht building is a major industry in the Netherlands. France, Italy, and Spain also seized several boats of billionaires since the start of the war in Ukraine. Luhansk civilians are urged to leave while it is still possible. The Luhansk regional governor, Serhiy Gaidai, has urged residents to get out while it is safe, quote unquote. I appeal to every resident of the Luhansk region, evacuate while it is safe, while there are buses and trains. Take this opportunity, he wrote on the Telegram messaging app. Earlier, Ukraine's general staff had warned Russian forces were regrouping and preparing, quote, to establish complete control over the territory of Donetsk and Luhansk regions. And part of the two regions have been under the control of Russia-backed rebels since 2014. Ukraine's president to Hungary has was summoned by the foreign ministry over offensive statements on Hungary's stance regarding the war. It's time for Ukrainian leaders to stop their insults directed at Hungary, Foreign Minister Péter Szijjártó had said. In a Facebook post, Szijjártó said that Hungary condemned the Russian invasion, allowed refugees, and supported Ukraine's territorial integrity. However, he added, this is not our war, so we want and will stay out of it. He said that Hungary would not send weapons to Ukraine or support energy sanctions against Russia. Ukrainian ambassador to Hungary, Lyubov Nepop, has been very outspoken in calling on Budapest to do more to support its neighbor. Hungary's Prime Minister Viktor Orban has won a fourth term by a landslide in the country's general election over the weekend. He slammed Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky and the European Union in a victory speech, calling them opponents, quote unquote. The United Kingdom says that the situation in Mariupol is worsening. The humanitarian situation in the besieged city of Mariupol is worsening, according to British military intelligence. In its latest intelligence update, the United Kingdom's Ministry of Defense said that heavy fighting and Russian airstrikes have continued in the southern Ukrainian city. Most of the 160,000 remaining residents have no light, communication, medicine, heat, or water, the ministry said. It accuses Russian forces of blocking humanitarian access to the city. Earlier, the Russian Defense Ministry said its forces would, quote, liberate Mariupol from Ukrainian nationalists. It fits with Moscow's stated goal to control the Donbas region in Ukraine's east, including Mariupol. Well, the U.S. is approving the transfer of anti-armor weaponry to Ukraine. United States Secretary of State Antony Blinken said that the United States has approved a further $100 million dollars in military aid to Ukraine, including anti-armor systems. Blinken said that Ukraine was in urgent need of anti-armor weaponry. The transfer will be funded as part of the $13.6 billion in aid for Ukraine earmarked by the U.S. Congress. Since the beginning of last year, the United States military assistance to Ukraine has totaled $2.4 billion. Seems that 400 residents are missing from Kyiv suburb Hostomel, so say the Ukrainian authorities. The head of the local Ukrainian military administration in the town of Hostomel said that around 400 residents were missing after 35 days of Russian occupation. Hostomel is located northwest of Kyiv and is home to an airport of the same name that receives international cargo planes. Most of its 16,000 residents have fled the area. Taras Dumenko said that authorities were currently searching basements in the town to find missing residents. He said that the bodies of a number of civilians who are known to have been killed have yet to be found. Several Hostomel residents have been found in Musha, which lies immediately south of Hostomel. Ukrainian troops took back control of Hostomel a few days ago, along with the nearby settlements of Busha and Irpin. Well, it looks like New Zealand's going to impose new Russia sanctions. New Zealand will impose new sanctions against Russia, the government announced. The government said that it would impose a 35% tariff on all imports from Russia, as well as a ban on the export of certain products such as ICT equipment. I don't know what ICT equipment is, and engines. The images and reports emerging of atrocities committed against civilians in Busha and other regions of Ukraine is abhorrent and reprehensible, and New Zealand continues to respond to Russian President Vladimir Putin's mindless acts of aggression, end quote, the Foreign Affairs Minister Nanaia Mahuta said in a statement. Quote, these tariff increases work in conjunction with the international community as we seek to pressure Putin's regime, she added. Well, the U.S. chipmaker Intel is suspending Russia operations. The United States semiconductor firm Intel has announced it is suspending its operations in Russia due to the invasion of Ukraine effective immediately. Quote, Intel continues to join the global community in condemning Russia's war against Ukraine and calling for a swift return to peace, end quote, the company said. We are working to support all of our employees through this difficult situation, including our 1,200 employees in Russia, Intel added. We have also implemented business continuity measures to minimize disruption to our global operations. Zelensky said that the Ukrainian army is holding back Russian forces. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said in his daily video address that the Ukrainian army was holding back Russian forces as they tried to push deep into Ukraine. Zelensky added that Russia was gathering up reinforcements for a fresh offensive. He said that that Ukraine was outnumbered in terms of both troops and equipment. A U.S. general says that Ukraine conflict could last for years. General Mark Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff in the United States Department of Defense, said in testimony to Congress that the war in Ukraine could last for years. I do think this is a very protracted conflict, and I think it is at least measured in years, end quote, Milley had said. Milley added that the U.S. and other countries supporting Ukraine will be involved in this for quite some time, quote, end quote. The general said that the U.S. should establish permanent bases, quote, end quote, in Eastern Europe, but with, quote, rotational, end quote, rather than permanently stationed troops. Quote, my advice would be to create permanent bases but not permanently station forces there. So you get the effect of permanence by rotational forces cycling through permanent bases, Milley said, adding that the Baltic states, Romania, and Poland would be willing to pay for such bases. Now, Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin said that expansion of the U.S. military presence in Eastern Europe was a work in progress, adding that this issue will probably be discussed as the NATO summit in June. Now, there's a summary of events in Ukraine-Russia crisis on Tuesday. Well, the British Foreign Ministry said that the United Kingdom had frozen some $350 billion in assets of what they called Russian President Vladimir Putin's war chest. Italy, Spain, and Slovenia expelled Russian diplomats from their soil in response to the atrocities in the city of Busha in Ukraine. The medical charity group Doctors Without Borders, Médecins Sans Frontières, MSF, said in a statement that its team had witnessed bombings in Mykolaiv, Ukraine. Estonia decided to close the Consul General of the Russian Federation in Narva and the Consular Office of the Russian Embassy in Tartu. Latvia also decided to close two Russian consulates and expel their staff. Germany said it would loan Moldova $55 million on top of a support package of €40 million and to help cope with the influx of refugees. That's about $47 million. Anyway, President Volodymyr Zelensky said on Ukrainian television that he would consider it a victory if Russian troops returned behind the line of contact in the Donbas region, which has separated Moscow-backed militias from the rest of the Ukraine since 2014. Zelensky said that if Ukraine tried to retake the occupied territories in Luhansk and Donetsk by force today, it would cost Ukrainians hundreds of thousands of lives. So, I guess that's the story there. Unbelievable. Let me just quickly look and see what else we can share with you at the moment. Bear with me a second here. I tell you, unbelievable. What a horror. Never thought any of this sort of stuff would ever happen in my time, but evidently it was overdue, I guess. This is very, very interesting. A French priest renowned for uncovering massacres is warning of the Boussas everywhere. Over the past 2 decades, Father Patrick Desbois, a French Catholic priest, has been identifying World War II atrocity sites and covering evidence of overlooked massacres after doing similar work with the Yazidi victims of the Islamic State group in Iraq and Syria. He is now back in Ukraine, collecting testimonies from the victims of the Russian invasion. Father Patrick Desbois' mission is to fight the bigotry that causes genocide, which began 20 years ago in the western Ukrainian city of Ravaruska near the Polish border. His grandfather was one of 25,000 French soldiers detained in a notorious Nazi camp in the city during World War II, prompted the French Catholic priest to make his first trip to Ravaruska back in 2002. The celebrated Holocaust memory keeper has since worked tirelessly to document the mechanics of mass murder, receiving numerous awards, including the Légion d'honneur, France's highest honor along the way. That's the Legion of Honor. Following the rise of the Islamic State group, Desbois began working on the Yazidi genocide in northern Iraq's Sinjar region in 2014. The 66-year-old Catholic priest is the founder of the Yahad in Unum, an NGO, a non-governmental organization dedicated to uncovering genocidal practices, and is the author of several books, including The Holocaust by Bullets, As the Overlooked 1940s Massacre of Nazi Mobile Death Camps and Local Auxiliaries Came to Be Known. 20 years after his first trip to a Nazi camp in Ukraine, Desbois is once again focused on Eastern Europe. Shortly after Russia invaded Ukraine on February 24, the French Catholic priest, who is also the academic director of the Babi Yar Memorial in the Ukrainian capital of Kyiv, started collecting testimonies on the conflict. Horrific images coming in from Bucha and other towns and cities in the Kyiv region area has highlighted the need for such work as the international legal community examines ways to seek justice for victims of the conflict. Desbois spoke to France 24 about his latest work, recording testimonies via video conferencing platforms. So France 24 had asked him, why did you decide to launch this collection of testimonies in the current war in Ukraine? Father Desbois said that when the war in Ukraine broke out, one of my best friends, Ruslan Ravatsyuk, the Babi Yar Memorial Deputy Director, said this terrible sentence to me. Patrick, you are going to come back for our mass graves, he said. I really didn't think there would be any. But when we started to see the massacres of civilians without any military motivation, it seemed obvious to me to do this collective work. If I don't do it, who will? We have been working in Ukraine for 20 years. In total, we have interviewed 8,000 people from the former Soviet Union who witnessed the Holocaust by bullets. We know a lot of people, the villages, and the topography. Fontaine Cat asks again, how do you go about collecting these testimonies? Father Desbois said, we are a team of 4 people here in Western Europe, and we have a team of a dozen mediators on site. One of them is in Irpin near Kyiv and is looking for witnesses. He knows many people and introduces us to people on the ground. We also feel the urgency to do it since witnesses can quickly disperse. People are willing to talk openly on Zoom and reveal their true identities. This surprised me. No matter the horrors and damage they have suffered, they want to stay in their country and defend it. In all the investigations I've done over the years, I've never seen that. I recorded the testimony of a woman who was injured and in hospital, for instance. She had lost part of her family while they were in a car. She almost cried during the interview, but when she was done, she said, "As soon as I get better, I'm getting on with my life and going to help people." I couldn't believe it. There's definitely a spirit of resilience. Continuing, Franz Rancat says, "How was the work you've already done on mass crimes helped you?" Father Dubois said, "In Iraq, we filmed 450 Yazidis who had just emerged from Daesh or the Islamic State group captivity and were trying to identify their rapists or murderers of community members. Without these previous experiences, we couldn't do this work today. We know how to handle these kinds of interviews. I'm thinking of a woman who was in a car with her 3-year-old son on her lap. She told us that she realized right away that a bullet had passed through her child's body. She was asked many details about the color of the car, whether it could have been mistaken for a military vehicle and the exact location of the attack. We had to be able to locate it on an interactive map and see if there were any military targets in that area, because it is clear that the Russians will say that it was collateral damage and that there were no attacks on civilians. Current denial by the Russians is particularly striking. When they bomb a maternity hospital, as they did in Mariupol, they say it was no longer a maternity hospital and that there were no pregnant women. They deny the crime as soon as it is denounced. For the bodies found in Bucha, they say that they were placed there, that they are not dead, and that the corpses are moving. Historically, I've never seen this. Every time a crime is discovered, they, meaning Russia, deny it in the same day in detail. These quick denials are explained by the acceleration due to social media and by the fact that the war led by President Vladimir Putin is supported by unimaginable propaganda. Any loopholes in the propaganda must be closed right away. I also think that the announcement of the opening of investigations by the International Criminal Court of Trials in France or Germany, the Russians know that legal action will be taken. They are looking for immediate protection. The testimonies we collect will be evidence for these investigations. François Katz says, "How did you feel when you saw the images of the abuses committed in Bucha?" The father said, "It made me think of the streets of the Rwandan capital of Kigali. I don't understand when, why Kigali? He never talked about Rwanda before. We knew that crimes had been committed in Ukraine, but until then, we did not know that the Russians had shot people en masse and that they had used the method of mass graves. By broadcasting these images, we show that the Russian authorities, that they are under our watch. We say to them, we know that you kill civilians. We know that you rape women. We know that you loot apartments. The whole world is watching and you will be judged. Your denials will not hold up. Even so, I fear that the Russians are thinking that they made a mistake in Bucha and are now deciding to make the evidence disappear, as was done in a lot during World War II. They know that their victims and their crimes are being exposed and that they may decide to give such orders to destroy evidence." Franz Rancat says, "Are there also similarities with the World War II testimonies you have collected?" So the father says, "People who have been brainwashed by propaganda turn into criminals who can commit rape, robbery, and murder. I saw this several times in villages hit by the Germans. They arrived declaring their supposed race purity and said that they were only eliminating a sub-race. But when you saw them in the field, they were raping women, slaughtering families, and looting apartments. There is no such thing as a pure crime. And what you see happening today, someone has been able to launch an ideology that mobilizes the population and an army in this way, and that this propaganda continues to work, is almost unreal. People think that humanity has advanced on these issues, but apparently freedom of conscience is very fragile. It is almost unbelievable that these crimes committed almost in public are happening on the borders of Europe. 2.5 hours by plane from Paris. Everyone is revolted by Bucha, but I wonder what it will be like when Mariupol is liberated. We can expect much larger scenes of massacres. There will be Bouchas everywhere." And just so you know, this article has been translated from the original in French. Unbelievable. And was issued by François Katz. and I think we read some previous stuff to you that came from Deutsche Welle. All right, I guess that has to be our time together now. Bear with me a moment. Okay. All right.